The following lecture was delivered at the 18th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Miami, Florida, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Mrs. Rivka Slonim will now present her lecture, The Campus Battleground, a report.
When October 7th happened, it wasn't like the rug was pulled out from beneath anyone's feet. I think for our students, it felt like there was no longer a floor to stand on, except for us. In Israel, there was and continues to be a lot of discussion about how October 7th could have happened. And they speak about the conceptzia. They speak about how Israel's concept about what Hamas was capable of and what they would do strategically and so on and so forth was wrong. And so when you have the army and the intelligence operating with an erroneous conceptzia, you have a problem. Well, guess what? The conception enjoyed by Jews in the US and all over the Western world was also erroneous. And our students found out that the conception of enjoying complete acceptance into wider society, safety as a full-fledged American citizen, and societal approval as allies of all things liberal and progressive, that was not enough of an assurance policy. That conception was rudely ripped away from them as the brutal and enormous tragedy of 10/7 gave way to a malignant and impossible to ignore strain of Jewish hatred. And yes, let's call it what it is, because talking about anti-Semitism, which is an antiquated term, it's a colloquialism based on an obsolete term for an ethnic, cultural, or racial group associated with the people of the Middle East, as practiced by Semites and their supporters, useful idiots or pernicious enemies alike, that term does not help us at all. If anything, it aids and abets the sanitizing of this despicable behavior, and it obfuscates what is really going on. And everyone was suffering and is suffering whiplash. Nary a week had gone by after October 7th before the first voices accusing Israel of genocide rang out. What? We who coined the term in the 1940s, specifically a Jewish attorney named Raphael Lemkin, a contraction of the word genos, the Greek word for race or people, combined with the Latin suffix for act of killing. He coined it to describe the Holocaust. Genocide is the crime of all crimes. And now we are being accused of this atrocity because we dare to defend ourselves against enemies who vow to do what they did on October 7th again and again and again. And this accusation wasn't just coming from the margins. This was not peripheral. It comes from within the rank and file of America, including from the sitting vice president, who modulates her thinly veiled accusations by bemoaning the fact that too many civilians have been killed. For her good, I hope we don't find ourselves in the same room, because the accusations coming from America, who engaged in post 9/11 wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq and Syria and Yemen to the frightening human cost of almost a million people, 905,000 people, of which 408,749 were civilians. In the current war, it's impossible, as everybody concedes, to discern the difference between the troops and civilians. Everyone knows that. And the number, according to the United Nations, of people who died, which includes the terrorists, is 34,900. According to Al Jazeera, it's 39,897. So who's calling the kettle black? And is it genocide when you warn civilians to leave an area before you go in there? And is it genocide when you give, when you keep giving them supplies so they could be strengthened, so they could kill us? So it's been a painful, frightening, difficult year on campuses everywhere. No matter where, it was merely about degree and iteration. It's been disquieting to have every orthodoxy upended, every paradigm shift, and then shift again, ricocheting always in the direction of placing the blame on our doorstep. And honestly, when I leave here on Sunday and I come back to Binghamton for the new semester, I have no idea what we're about to face. None. Either way, there's no going back to before October 6th. Too much has been said. Too much has been left unsaid. Too much has happened. Too much has not happened. We simply don't live in the same world, the same country, the same reality we inhabited 10 months ago. Or at least the country, the world, the reality we thought we inhabited. So what do we do now? How do we prepare properly and responsibly to the best of our ability to do so? I can only share my truth. This is just one person's perspective. A mere 6 years ago, but what now seems like decades ago, in 2018, I spoke at this retreat, and I cited statistics surrounding BDS resolutions on campuses, and I opined that it was hardly our biggest problem. Instead, I laid out what I thought was truly a crisis, widespread BDS of a different kind, a large, frightfully large percentage of our Jewish students on campuses, our Jewish children, fall into one of three categories. B, they're burnt out and bitter. They went to Hebrew school or received some other form of Jewish education, most often suffered a lackluster experience. They have in their minds and hearts been there, done that. They know everything they care to know about Judaism, and in some cases they harbor anger, animosity, disappointment towards the organized Jewish community for reasons real or imagined. Then you have the D, the disinterested and the disenfranchised. They never went to Hebrew school, they got no Jewish instruction, they have no interest. Their religion and the religion of their mothers may or may not be atheism or liberalism or progressivism. And then you have the S, satisfied with the status quo. These kids are just Jewish, whatever that means, and they will go to Yom Kippur services if it makes grandma happy and they get a check. And they will light the menorah on Hanukkah, and they will even do you the favor of eating latkes and hamantaschen. But don't think for a second that dating exclusively Jewish is on their radar. 6 years later, I stand here, after a year during which anti-Israel encampments, BDS resolutions, acts of violence and hate speech directed at Jewish students escalated, skyrocketed beyond anything anyone could ever imagine. A time during which we saw and heard things no one would have believed possible in America. Even after seeing the fruition of years of money flowing from Qatar and others in the systematic infiltration of the academy, the administrative positions, the endowed chairs in various departments, combined, of course, with strong dosages of DEI dogma and, everybody's darling, intersectionality. This has spawned a particularly noxious mutation of the perennial virus we call antisemitism. And after all of that, I can stand here and I can tell you that I am even more strongly convinced that our biggest problem is not coming from without. We have problems, but that's not our biggest problem. I am ever more strongly convinced that it's the disaffection from our Jewish heritage on the part of so many of our youth that is our most urgent problem today. That is what deserves the largest measure of our attention and our communal resources. I still believe our biggest problem on and off campus is not Jewish hatred, but rather apathy towards, ignorance of, and disconnection from Judaism, Yiddishkeit, the millennia-long cosmic Jewish project. And yes, October 7th jump-started a groundswell of passion for Judaism in Israel. Yes, that was heartening to see. Yes, some Jewish students broke up with their non-Jewish significant others because they realized how profoundly differently they saw and experienced the world around them, and how people from beyond our faith community saw them. Yes, many students rallied and became more active, but it's not nearly enough. And let me concretize this for you. On October 9th, at 6:30 p.m., we held a vigil in the Peace Quad of Binghamton University in support of Israel and the hostages, and to mourn the 1,200-plus victims of the barbaric Hamas slaughter. It was all of the Jewish organizations on campus together who organized this event. It was just 2 days, 48 hours after the bloodiest day in Jewish history since the Holocaust. By all accounts, there are over 3,000 Jewish students at Binghamton. There were 500 that showed up. It was considered a huge gathering. On November 14th, a month and some days later, American Jews gathered on the Mall in Washington in support of Israel and to demand the return of the hostages. According to various news estimates, somewhere between 250,000 and 300,000 people showed up. The reports vary. Let's for the moment take the most optimistic inflated number. In 1987, 3 years after we got to Binghamton, in the March for Soviet Jewry, in the very same location in Washington, 250,000 Jews were reported to have attended by the lowest estimate. Now, a generation is understood to be somewhere between 15 and 30 years. We should have been able to, at the very least, double the number from 1987, or double and a half, or triple. We were very clearly, woefully short of doubling our number. In 1987, Binghamton had 5 buses of students who went to Washington. In 2023, we had only 4. We were told that we had the largest contingent from one single university outside of Yeshiva University. It was meant as a compliment, but it made me cry. I am heartbroken. We should have been able to gather 20 buses. The kids weren't paying a penny. We catered 3 meals plus snacks on coach buses, not the school buses the kids traveled in 1987 on. But they couldn't be bothered to spend a day away from their normal routine. No matter what we did, we couldn't garner enough takers. Why? For a very simple reason: apathy towards, ignorance of, and disconnection from who they are. Kids who have no idea that the land of Israel is a holy land, promised to the Jewish people by God, given to us millennia ago, are at best disinterested, but they are, more likely, at great risk for seeing Israel as a colonist entity trying to eject the indigenous people of the land. Kids who don't identify strongly and proudly as Jews, who don't identify as children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren of those who were expelled and exiled from the Holy Land after the destruction of the Holy Temples, who have spent the last 2,000 years pining to come back, see only the oppressor in the face of Jews who live in Israel. They have no idea how many hundreds of thousands of Jews have been expelled from Muslim majority countries in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. And that's just in the 20th century. As Jews, our narrative has never been one of victimhood. Let's just say we don't do oppression. Ergo, by today's social constructs, we must be the oppressors. The joke in Israel the day after Iran sent enough missiles to kill everybody, if God had not intervened, what was the joke on the street? Everybody got up, everybody went to work, everybody went to school, and the joke was, we're all jet-lagged. Nobody slept the night before. But that wasn't a reason not to get up and go to work and go to school and send your kids out. Perhaps subconsciously, some students believe that aggressively fighting for the Palestinian cause affords them protection from the flagrant Jewish hatred. I am just like you, they scream in futility to a world that is completely tone deaf to this cry. Everyone seems up in arms about the anti-Semitism on campuses, and it is horrible. There are good organizations doing all kinds of important work to combat this kind of hatred in the halls of Washington and on the more local state and municipality levels, as well as in the academy and the more general public thoroughfare. And this work is integral. But let me tell you what we are not going to be doing. We are not going to be making anti-Semitism the centerpiece of our work. Because making that the centerpiece of our communal agenda, and specifically what we do for our young students, is another terrible mistake we cannot afford to make. Trust me, the outcry from parents and alumni was just another full-time job we had to manage. And yes, the university should hear from its constituency, and there's no reason to throw more money at them. Absolutely. But scaring our children, telling them not to go to Chabad, telling them to stick their Star of David in, telling them to take off their mezuzah, that is just dead wrong. As a Chabad shlucha, as an emissary of the Rebbe, like all of the shluchim and shluchos, we take our marching orders from the Rebbe's teachings. I want to share with you what we have done and what we have every intention of continuing and building upon in this coming year, and why that is the case. Even someone casually familiar with the Rebbe and his teachings can quickly discern that he did not make anti-Semitism central to his vision and program. And he had every reason to do so. Having lived through the Holocaust and before that in Stalinist Russia, having lost so many family members to Jew hatred, he was only too aware of the viciousness of this most resistant of all viruses. He knew only too well the depth of this most durable of all conspiracy theories, the profundity of this baseless, senseless hatred. But he refused to make this a focal point of his efforts. Instead, he turned to changing the Jewish world by injecting joy and pride into Jewish life. He created the most inclusive, welcoming, but never patronizing network of Jewish embassies throughout the world where anybody could feel safe and welcome. He taught that Jewish life does not and never has grown out of negative energy. It grows out of love. The Rebbe did not believe in backing down, in keeping a low profile, in ducking out of sight. He vociferously believed that Jews who respect themselves and their tradition will be respected, Never, ever did the Rebbe believe that what our enemies have to say about us and what they do should determine our agenda. And generally speaking, he did not believe calling out anti-Semitism would in any way effectively curtail it. At the same time, the Rebbe was exquisitely pragmatic, not to mention visionary, prophetic, really, in mapping out what Israel had to do to protect herself. The Rebbe was the most ardent lover and defender of the IDF. And this binary expressed itself in many different ways, and I'll just cite two. In 1964, Harvey Swatos, a celebrated novelist and social critic, had a personal meeting with the Rebbe. And he asked the Rebbe in 1964 if the Rebbe believed that the Holocaust could happen again. Tomorrow morning, the Rebbe replied, explaining that the German penchant for following authoritative orders, for carrying out orders, is deeply entrenched in their culture. And at the same time, the Rebbe believed that it was integral to build alliances, to forge connections, to engage people of influence. In one very famous letter, in a postscript, the Rebbe writes, I trust you, to this high-profile person, I trust you will agree that in regard to persons of influence, whether in Washington or elsewhere, the first objective should be to persuade and encourage such a person to use his influence in a positive way in behalf of any and all good causes. We should welcome every public appearance which lends public support to the cause, especially when there is a likelihood that it may be a forerunner of similar pronouncements in the future. The Rebbe continues, what was at stake here was that this person wrote to the Rebbe that he couldn't believe that Chabad was welcoming somebody who had been, let's just say, less than friendly to Israel in the past. And so the Rebbe was replying, and the Rebbe continues, my experience with such people has convinced me that politicians are generally motivated more by expediency than by conviction. In other words, their public pronouncements of various issues do not stem from categorical principles or religious imperatives. Hence, most of them, if not all, are subject to change in their positions. And I believe, therefore, that the proper approach to such persons by Jewish leaders should not be rigid. As a rule, it does no good to engage in a cold war, which may often turn into a hot war, nor does it serve any useful purpose to brand one as an enemy or an anti-Semite. However tempting it is to do so, it can only be counterproductive. The Rebbe believed that ultimately the only way to root out evil, including anti-Semitism, was through education. Teachings that would nourish and nurture a higher sense of purpose and mission in every human being. And that absent such, the Jewish people, the standard bearers of these values and principles, would always elicit a jealousy and a hatred for those chosen to bring these messages to the world. And to this end, the Rebbe championed a moment of silence and introspection in all public schools, a non-denominational moment of silence. He championed teaching all people of the world about the seven Noahide universal moral laws. He over and over said, only with a consciousness of a higher power, an all-seeing eye, an all-hearing ear, can we evolve in a positive direction. So what are we going to do on campus? First and last, we will continue to provide a comprehensive web of services and programs and offerings to our students. We will embrace them in love with a robust, pulsating, happy, warm community on Shabbat, on Jewish holidays, and every day in between. We will give them whatever we can, talent nights, and game nights. Yes, religious services, social service opportunities, sports will bring chicken soup to their dorm room if they're not feeling well. We're training cohorts of students in a mental health fellowship to be good listeners. Last year, even as we went into overdrive after October 7th, organizing scores, and I do mean scores of events, focused on gathering our students to respond to what had happened, to inculcate Jewish pride, sending money and supplies to Israel. Randy, stand for a minute. Even bringing our students and alumni and parents of Chabad of Binghamton students on the first solidarity trip to Israel after the war. It wasn't even a thing, but Rabbi Levy snagged the first tickets that became available to non-IDF reservists. And on October 27th, Randy DeFilip and a group of students chosen through a raffle, a lottery, and alumni spent 18 hours, there were no beds involved in this trip, visiting people on all the various fronts. But with all of that, our undiluted focus remained on keeping the scores of everyday programs and classes and services and amenities even more vibrant and compelling than ever. Yes, our students needed solace and they needed support. Of course they did. We still have a Bearcat, a Binghamton student who was supposed to enter Binghamton last year in January 24 in Gaza. In the immediate days after October 7th, we had Chabad staff stationed in our lobby 24/7. We brought a huge, we rented a huge truck. We brought up a cohort of yeshiva students. We blared Jewish music. We offered opportunities for students to do mitzvot. And of course, to enjoy the hug of the day in the form of some hot soup or some freshly baked cookies. But more than anything, our students needed to gather in number on Friday nights and holidays. They had to come to learn about who they are, take part in Jewish life on a regular basis, because they needed and they need to live and breathe and eat and drink and cry and laugh and grow and learn and celebrate and mourn as Jewish individuals, as Jews who are part of a collective. They need to have at least some knowledge of and some respect for the history that spans millennia and what it is exactly that has brought us to this point. And by the way, the non-Jewish students need to be part of our focus as well. And we did that by offering a mitzvah marathon to all of our students and other such broader appeal programs. Which is why we have and will continue to do our best to share the Rebbe's wisdom and vision with our beloved students. And if you want to know what we're going to be doing, I am going to give you a glimmer now in the Rebbe's own words. I'm going to share with you brief extractions from a question and answer period that students enjoyed with the Rebbe. College students came to visit in 1963, and they asked with the freshness and the brashness of youth, pointed questions. And of course, the Rebbe did not back down, and he answered their questions. And it's not like I'm going to stand there and read these questions and answers to our students. But this is the wisdom I hope they will swallow with the soup and the matzo balls and, of course, the sesame noodles. The students asked the Rebbe, what is your opinion of the Jews of today compared to the Jews of long ago? Isn't that a fantastic question? 1963. Here's what the Rebbe said. Here's what our students need to know. He said, in my opinion, you are so lucky in relation to the Jews of thousands and hundreds of years ago. In the past, when a Jew is asked the reason why his or her behavior was different from all the people around, the Jew had no history to persuade people that this way of life was correct, for the Jewish people were that much younger. Fewer generations had passed. But now, after 3,000 years of history, in many different countries and conditions, 99% of these times under non-beneficial conditions, though no trace remains of the people who oppressed them, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Romans, the Greeks, the Jews survived all their oppressions, including Hitler's. All of recorded history is only 4,000 to 5,000 years, no longer. And for 3,000 of the 5,000 years, a single unusual phenomenon has occurred. A people who were always persecuted and a minority always survived its oppressors, who were many times bigger. So in addition to joy and pride, our students need to know just how privileged they are. The students pressed further. They asked the Rebbe, what has kept the Jews together? What do you think has caused the Jews to last all these years? Unflinching, the Rebbe looked at them and said, we're going to approach this in a scientific manner. We must study history and find out the common points and denominators that have not changed. If for 3,000 years we withstood all of the persecutions and all the pogroms and all the pressures, then there must be something distinctive during all those 3,000 years, a common point that was present throughout. If we study Jewish history, the Rebbe continued, we see that all things change. The language, the territory, the government, the clothing, the culture, the outside world. Here we speak English. In Russia, the Jews spoke Russian. In the land of Israel, they speak Hebrew. The same differences existed 1,000 years ago. And the only unchanged thing in all these years are the mitzvot. The tefillin have not changed. The same goes for Shabbat and the dietary laws. We have the same Torah as 1,000 and 2,000 and 2,500 years ago and 3,000 years ago. That is the reason. That's the secret. Strictly from a point of historical research, the Rebbe said, we must accept the facts, even if we don't understand them, that the only common point has been the practical mitzvot. Do you think, they continued to press, that the Jewish people will always be a minority? Yes, said the Rebbe. We probably will be in the future. But this does not bother me at all. Now listen to logic. If we compare vegetable life to inorganic matter, the inorganic matter is more abundant. Vegetable life is more in quantity than animal life, and animal life more than humans. Nevertheless, we do not expect humans to be more in number than the animals, the vegetables, and the inorganic, inanimate matter around them. The important factor is who directs all these things. If the human is kind and peaceful, or like an animal, a vegetable, or an inorganic thing. We don't have to be many. We don't have to be the most. We just have to do our thing. And then, the students asked, since the establishment of the State of Israel, the American Jew is confronted with the problem of dual allegiance. Which should have priority? The Rebbe says, I don't find a contradiction between them. The main thing is spiritual values, Then come the secondary ones, the army guarding the borders and all other things. One's main purpose must be to become a holy people. Do not be afraid. You can become part of a kingdom of priests. And do that while you are a professional, a businessman, an engineer, a doctor, etc. In the 60s, the rest of the Jewish establishment looked askance, that's kind, in disdain, really, at what was happening on college campuses. Student unrest, hippies and freaks, a deranged and lost generation. And the Rebbe said, finally, the iceberg of America is beginning to melt. Finally, the young people are demonstrating that conformity is not the sum of life's goals. They have smashed the idols of false progress. They need now only to be led back to the living waters of their heritage. These students mean well. They are passionate. They want to make a difference. I don't have to agree to be able to respect them. But they're all welcome at Chabad, and always will be. And sometimes it's not so simple and it's not so easy. It's a big challenge. But the answer is keeping an open heart towards these kids and making sure they know that no matter what their politics are, they have a seat at our table. I want to close with a beautiful vignette that noted American author Herman Wolk related. In describing the Rebbe, Herman Wolk, who was a wordsmith, a master, he said, the Rebbe was the most optimistic Jew to ever live in history. Everyone was down on the state of American Jewry in the 60s, even going into the 70s. But the Rebbe said, given the dismal state of Jewish education, it was amazing to see what American Jews were observing and doing. And then the Rebbe said, the American Jewish community is a wonderful community. You can't tell them to do anything, but you can teach them to do everything. One of the things we did, like October 14th or something, is bring up a team of school psychologists to speak to our students, to give them tools for facing their instructors, their classmates, the people they were sitting next to, who they thought were their friends, but turns out you look at their social media platform. And look, haters are going to hate. And until Mashiach comes, there's going to be anti-Semitism. But if we teach our children to be proud of who they are, to carry themselves with dignity and with pride, to ask the instructor that said something extremely upsetting if you could speak to them during office hours, you have at least 50% chance that this will end better than you thought. Because there's an awful lot of ignorance out there. And in my experience, I had students who did exactly that and actually went and bought books for their instructors. Yeah, it's a little funny that the kids have to buy books for their instructors so they can learn the history of the conflict in the Middle East. But that's what happened. But a lot of kids don't have that type of moxie. They need a lot of hand-holding. We worked with the deans, we worked with the president, but you know what? No matter what we did, it wasn't enough for some parents and some alumni, and it wasn't helpful having to manage that along with everything else. And at a certain point, young people have to learn to stand up for themselves. They have to learn what they believe, who they are, where they come from, and where they're going. So we did a lot of making copies of important facts that they could use. We talked to them about buying books that could be helpful. I'm convinced I single-handedly sold 2,000 of a book I think is an excellent reader for a college kid on the current conflict. I said to our graduating class this year that I know a lot of people were bemoaning this particular class because they were the class that came in during COVID. That was their freshman year. And they were leaving during this time. And at Binghamton, different than some other universities, they were pretty privileged because the location of their graduation did not have to be kept on the DL. It wasn't moved three times. The encampments were gotten rid of pretty soon. We had a girl that comes to Chabad 100 times a week speak at one of the graduations. But still, they felt beleaguered, and everybody was bemoaning them. And I don't necessarily enjoy being a contrarian, but I got up and I said to them, sorry, but I don't feel bad for you. Because you got tools that are necessary and important for going forward in life. You will be stronger people. It's not a message our kids hear enough of today. And so in the final analysis, what our college students need from us more than anything else is CBD, Chabad, Chachma, wisdom, Bina, understanding, and Da'at, knowledge. But not abstruse theoretic knowledge, connected knowledge, joyous, visceral, proud knowledge. They need to be part of a community that's pulsating with Jewish joy and proud. Let's be real. We're among friends here. We already know how the current conflicts and difficulties are going to end. Because it always ends the same way. We are going to persevere. We are going to emerge, despite all the mistakes we're making, intact and stronger. But we dare not drop the ball. We dare not leave one student behind. That is our mandate. That is our privilege. Everyone here can help in this most important endeavor. And like they're saying in Israel, "Biyachad ninatzeach." Together we will be successful. But I'm standing here and I'm literally begging everyone, do what you can towards this cause. This is nothing less than our future. This front is no less important and no less dangerous than any of the fronts, Gaza, the North, the West Bank. Thank you.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.